Liegen over een mondkapjesdeal die je hebt gesloten met de overheid. Een deal waarmee je miljoenen hebt verdiend. Dat doet toch alleen Siewert van Liende? Nou, nee. Ik ben Felicia Alberding en in de Mondkapjesmiljonairs duik ik met een team van correspondenten in andere schandalen. Want wist je dat Siewert helemaal niet uniek is? Luister de Mondkapjesmiljonairs in je Podimo-app. Of ga naar podimo.nl/mondkapjes. En probeer Podimo 30 dagen. Podimo.nl/mondkapjes.
Voor je gaat luisteren, heel even dit. In de nieuwe podcast Veldheren neem ik, Jos de Groot, jou iedere donderdag mee voorbij de frontlijn in Oekraïne. Dat doe ik samen met generaals buitendienst Peter van Umm en Mart de Kruijf. Zij hebben één duidelijk doel: aan jou uitleggen hoe oorlog werkt. Volg Veldheren in jouw favoriete podcast-app.
All of us here today do not want to see our election victory stolen by emboldened radical left Democrats, which is what they're doing, and stolen by the fake news media. That's what they've done and what they're doing. We will never give up. We will never concede. It doesn't happen. You don't concede when there's theft involved. We will stop the steal. We won this election, and we won it by a landslide. This was not a close election. I've been in two elections. I won them both, and the second one, I won much bigger than the first, okay?
I would say that in large measure, no one ever tells Donald Trump the truth. He doesn't want to hear the truth. He wants to hear what he wants to hear. And if you don't tell him that, he will find somebody else who will. All that is required to live another day in the Republican Party is loyalty to Donald Trump.
Dit is Betrouwbare Bronnen met Jaap Janssen.
Hallo, welkom in Betrouwbare Bronnen aflevering 206 en welkom ook PG.
Dag Jaap.
We hebben deze week een zeer interessante gast, een oude bekende ook, want hij was in juli 2019 al eens bij ons. Maar eerst wil ik graag de nieuwe vrienden van de show welkom heten. Luisteraars die met een donatie Betrouwbare Bronnen mede mogelijk maken. De nieuwe vrienden zijn Jasper, René, Jeroen, Tim, Thijs, Rikst en Stefan.
Een mens kan nooit genoeg nieuwe vrienden krijgen, Jaap. Ik ben ze zeer erkentelijk.
En jij kunt ook vriend worden. Doe het nu nog. Dan kunnen we straks beginnen aan een mooi vierde seizoen. Vriend worden kan via vriendvandeshow.nl/bb. Dat is vriendvandeshow.nl/bb.
Jaap Janssen en Pieter Gerrit Kroeger duiken in de politieke geschiedenis.
Vandaag verschijnt de Nederlandse vertaling van het derde boek van Michael Wolff over president Donald J. Trump. Landslide, in het Nederlands uitgegeven door Prometheus als aardverschuiving, de laatste dagen van het Trump-bewind. Michael Wolff's tweede boek, Staat van Beleg, was voor ons in 2019 reden om toen ook al met hem te praten. We ontmoetten Wolff toen in Amsterdam. Op dit moment is Michael in New York en we zijn blij dat hij ook nu weer te gast is in Betrouwbare Bronnen.
Dit is Betrouwbare Bronnen.
Welcome again in Reliable Sources, Michael Wolff. How are we doing?
How is who doing?
America doing?
That's the thing Donald Trump always says when he's got someone on the phone. How are we doing?
He actually says yes. When he says that does not require a response. He doesn't really want a response. It's just an opening for him to begin.
Last time you were our guest, you told us that Donald Trump's character doesn't admit that he loses a national election. During his whole life, you said, when he faced imminent disaster, he declared victory and he left. And this was exactly what happened in November. You know him very well. And you even thought Trump might not go for a second term because of the risk of losing the elections. But he went for a second round. Why?
A good question. I think that because he thought he absolutely believed he could not lose. There's no real cynicism on his part here. It was a concerted belief that that against Joe Biden there was no contest. It just did, in nature itself, there was not the possibility that he could lose to Joe Biden.
Was there another Democratic, let's say, potential opponent that he did fear?
Yes, I think various opponents. There is a moment that I recount in the book in which he thought that the Democrats were actually going to push Joe Biden out of the race and nominate Andrew Cuomo, the governor of New York, and Michelle Obama as his vice president.
You must be kidding.
And Trump was enormous, afraid of this, so afraid that he refused to attack Joe Biden, thinking that would weaken him and enable the Democrats to make this shift.
So Donald Trump was glad, in his words, that Joe Biden stayed in his basement during the beginnings of the campaign.
Yes, absolutely. He literally, there was nothing in the president's or the former president's mind that allowed him to think that that Joe Biden could possibly win this election.
What made him afraid of Cuomo? Not the fact that Cuomo would get the electoral votes of the state of New York.
Well, you know, I mean, Cuomo had been out front on COVID and had become the kind of anti-Trump in terms of his performance as the governor of New York, and becoming the face of a politician trying to deal with the virus in a way that Donald Trump clearly was not.
Michael, you once said that two books about the Trump presidency was enough. Why did you nevertheless write a third one?
You know, I had no intention of writing a third until January 6th. And that was so bewildering and so concerning that it was like, I was like the guy lying on the bed and thinking, okay, well, I got to get up and put my boots back on. And I did.
What was so bewildering for you?
That it could possibly happen, that how it happened, why it happened, the meaning of what had transpired. I think that this was understanding this became the seminal journalistic question of that moment.
So it was more about understanding that event or that focus point than understanding Trump.
Well, I think that they were clearly connected. I mean, finally connected, directly connected.
Do you have, finishing this book now, for yourself an answer on what it meant?
You know, I think it has something to do with the relationship Donald Trump has to what we call his base. But I think that it somewhat makes more sense if you don't call it his political base, but call it his fan base. Donald Trump is an actor. I mean, I've always thought this. I mean, what has he succeeded at in life? He succeeded at being a television performer. And in some sense, in some highly, like an actor, in some highly emotional sense, he has bonded with this fan base. This bond with him is part of their identity, and so that led to this outpouring on January 6th, which I have never. I don't think the mainstream press or the liberal press has seen this as an insurrection and as an assault on democracy.
That was also the reason to start the second impeachment.
Exactly. And they have seen it as a conspiracy, as Donald Trump using this to as part of his effort to stay in office. And I don't think it's that.
It's not political.
In a way, I think it's something worse, or at least something harder to understand. It's this emotional reaction, which is which is directly related to the feelings about whatever Donald Trump represents to an enormous number of people. And I think part of the job here, and it's the ongoing job, is to understand exactly what that is.
Can I try to formulate it from a European perspective? These people have an enormous outpouring, the word you use is very good, of grief and of loss.
But at the same time, this is clearly mixed with some amount of celebration.
Yes. Yes.
It's mixed with, it's an event, you know, as old Donald Trump, you know, these, you know, when he does these stadium rallies, it's an event. It's there's something charismatic in the Christian sense about this.
That's why I use those words, grief and loss. It is a secular sort of religious apparition.
So you say you didn't suppose he was thinking of a coup d'etat, but on January 6th, he said to the crowd, "Walk with me to the Capitol."
We're going to walk down and I'll be there with you. We're going to walk down. We're going to walk down. Anyone you want, but I think right here, we're going to walk down to the Capitol. And we're going to cheer on our brave senators and congressmen and women. And we're probably not going to be cheering so much for some of them. Because you'll never take back our country with weakness. You have to show strength and you have to be strong.
When his aides heard this, this was one of the few lines he had ad-libbed in this speech. You know, usually he ad-libs virtually everything. This was a speech. He wasn't really focused on this audience. He was focused on what the vice president was going to do. But he ad-libbed this line that he was, let's walk, we'll walk to the Capitol. And the aides around him thought, what did he say? What, he's going to walk? And they thought, wait a minute, Donald Trump doesn't walk anywhere. So they thought this was extremely, I mean, there was no question in their minds that he was going to do this because he just doesn't do it.
Explain to our European audience, he doesn't walk. You mean this physically?
Physically, yes. I mean, walking is something that, lower class
servants
of
do.
People have to do. Yes. In the beginning of the Trump administration, there was a lot of, people who got offices on the second floor of the West Wing, where everybody said, they'll have no power because Donald Trump will never go up a flight of stairs. And in fact, in 4 years, he has never gone to the second floor. And then when he came off the stage saying we're going to walk, so he was confronted by his chief of staff, Mark Meadows, who said, obviously we can't arrange any security for this walk. And he said, what are you talking about? And Meadows said, you said you were going to walk. And Trump said, well, I didn't mean that literally. So this is a very, to say the least, a kind of a very odd way to run a coup d'etat.
By not walking.
After the election, there was only one thing Trump was talking about, his, quote, landslide victory and, quote, the steal of the elections by the Democrats. The first to call the important state of Arizona lost for Trump was Fox News, the main news source for his followers. The owner of Fox, Rupert Murdoch himself, ordered to call Arizona for Joe Biden. In the past, you wrote a book on Murdoch. Why does Rupert Murdoch hate Donald Trump?
He thinks he's a clown, thinks he's a fool. He thinks he is not a true conservative. Trump achieves fame in part through Rupert Murdoch's tabloid publications. So Murdoch sees him as a tabloid figure. In Murdoch's worldview, there's certainly nothing to recommend Donald Trump.
You said he sees him as not a true conservative. Could you explain that?
Well, he's not a true conservative. I mean, he was, you know, first he was a Democrat. He's taken, you know, all kinds of positions that are antithetical to conservative positions. And also in demeanor, he's not a conservative. He's quite the opposite of any kind of any upholder of conservative principles and behavior.
You mean somebody like President Bush Sr.?
Yeah, I mean, he's just, you know, Rupert Murdoch sees himself as a classic conservative, a businessman, you know, button down, you know, reticent, you know, the whole range of conservative values, fairly religious. You know, Trump is
none
a,
of that.
Is a not, yeah, to say the least, none of that. Yes.
After the elections, Trump was told that Angela Merkel, Emmanuel Macron, Mario Draghi were very supportive of his election challenge. You write, so not everyone in his circle was telling him the truth.
I would say that in large measure, no one ever tells Donald Trump the truth. He doesn't want to hear the truth. He wants to hear what he wants to hear. And if you don't tell him that, he will find somebody else who will. So it was very easy to tell him that a range of European leaders actually supported him because they were, you know, had their ambassadors call and say really they supported him, and this made him you know, and he was perfectly willing to believe this.
But as a European, of course, I'm now incredibly interested in who would be those people who would say to Donald Trump, in reality, Angela loves what you're doing.
Well, you know, I don't really think I think from the representatives from European leaders are not exactly saying this. They're just saying in the most diplomatic terms possible. And then Trump's aides and State Department people are taking that and flipping it around and saying, "Oh yeah, they're telling us that they really understand and they really hope you."
So it's people to people in Washington, let's say, who are close to the White House staff.
Or directly the White House staff. You know, whoever is in the White House is communicating with. I mean, obviously, is in touch with people who are either directly part of the leadership of foreign governments or directly in touch with those people who are in touch. And what is happening here is the people who are doing the misrepresentation are the people who are in direct communication with the president.
So people like Macron don't even know that this fairy tale is told
to them. Yes, total fairy tale. I mean, I can't imagine anybody in the European hierarchy is at fault here. I imagine they are all rather pleased to see Donald Trump lose the election, and rather concerned about his challenge to it. And they would have tried to communicate to the White House at best a kind of wait and see attitude, and then that would be turned into, oh yes, they support.
They were all deeply afraid, we know, about the transition, the completely, let's say, unregulated part of the American Constitution here.
So in a way, it's understandable that when Donald Trump heard that world leaders congratulated Biden, he became very furious.
Yes, I mean, you know, the oddest thing was Netanyahu, you know, a man abject in his loyalty and devotion to Donald Trump, but who at the expected moment said congratulations to Joe Biden, and that was he was immediately. Precisely because he had been so abject in his loyalty and because Trump thought he owed him so much, to do this was then a betrayal of Donald Trump.
This is very interesting because for me, reading your book on that part, this showed that Donald Trump, after 4 years of being a president, had no idea of what it is to be a statesman. Because Netanyahu did this because of the interest of Israel having a good relationship with the next president.
We would say the response would be, "Oh, you think?" He has no idea, no concern, no. It doesn't cross his mind. It doesn't. It's not part of his interest. You know, to be a statesman or to even begin to think what's involved with that doesn't cross Donald Trump's, it's just not part of his makeup.
He thinks also here completely transactional. He owes me.
Yes. I mean, even that, I hesitated only because it is in any sphere to begin to put a design on what Donald Trump wants or intends is probably going too far.
Dit is Betrouwbare Bronnen, een podcast met betrouwbare bronnen.
We talked about January 6th. In retrospect, it was a kind of campaign moment for the post-presidential period to maintain Trump's influence over the Republican Party. For us in Europe, it's not always easy to understand the relationship between Trump and the Republicans. In his 4 years in power, it looks to me like Trump held his party hostage. And I expected that the party would say goodbye to him as soon as possible, but that didn't happen. Why?
Because he's managed to maintain a very tight grip on his base, the word we seem to use for this. Whatever the percentage, 40%, 42%, 43% of the American electorate, he holds it tight. And that is the Republican Party.
So if you want to get reelected as a senator or as a congressman or woman, you more or less rely on Donald Trump.
Bingo. Yes. So the way to the Republican Party is only through Donald Trump at this point. Yes.
This is fascinating because certainly we as Europeans, we look at the Republican Party obviously from the way Europeans understand political parties as organized buildings with a common core of beliefs and traditions. And so we think Ronald Reagan, the Bushes, James Baker, you know what I mean, Condi Rice. That's not the base. That's not Donald Trump. What has happened to the Republican Party?
You know, I think the Republican Party has been transformed by a series of many developments, and I think the leadership of the Republican Party is often at odds with the base of the Republican Party, and they are brought together by Donald Trump, I think that's confusing to a lot of people. That's certainly a lot of people in the Republican Party. It's kind of an unresolved development, but for the moment, all that is required to live another day in the Republican Party is loyalty to Donald Trump. So for the meantime, that's what has happened. Now, there was a moment after January 6th when that seemed to There seemed to be an opportunity to confront Donald Trump to lay blame at the feet of Donald Trump. But then the Trump White House put a poll into the field. I think the poll came back on the 11th or the 12th, January 11th or 12th, and it showed virtually in a lack of concern about January 6th among the Republican base. And so everybody ran right back to Donald Trump.
So people like Mitch McConnell, the leader in the Senate, they had to go on with this Donald Trump.
Well, yeah. I mean, Mitch McConnell hates Donald Trump and doesn't speak to Donald Trump anymore and probably will never speak to him again. And Donald Trump says terrible things about Mitch McConnell.
What does he say?
You can go through a litany of Donald Trump words. He's a loser, a disloyal betrayer, an incompetent, a fool. So, and this is all yet unresolved. I mean, I would say that this brings us into the next phase of the Donald Trump story. Will he indeed be able to remake the Republican Party wholly in his image? Or will he, as he was on November 3rd, been defeated and ultimately robbed of his status and power? Unclear.
While he was president, he needed Mitch McConnell. He needed Paul Ryan, because he himself was not somebody who could govern to get things done, to get a program in.
Well, I wouldn't exactly put it that way. I mean, I don't think Donald Trump needed anything, because I don't think he cared about anything. I think he needed the attention and the awe and devotion of his base, which he appears never to be in danger of losing.
But the president wants to get things done.
No, I don't think Donald Trump wanted to get things done. He doesn't not interested in that. So therefore, Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan, they merely took advantage of the fact that that they could rely on the unity of the Republican base because of Donald Trump, and they could take the opportunity that Donald Trump had no real policies or policy interests of his own, so that they could then continue to implement a standard Republican conservative agenda.
Because that is one of the most remarkable things of the 4 years of the Trump presidency, is that all the great initiatives, Infrastructure Week, let me just mention this, repeal and replace Obamacare, nothing has been done in that sphere. But the classic Republican agenda, judges, taxes,
right,
and the military, have been done. And deregulation.
Exactly.
Can you say that Mitch McConnell, with all his parliamentary power, was the real governing person during the Trump years?
Well, I think he was the real architect of the Republican and the conservative agenda. Yes. I think the larger zeitgeist, however, the political direction of the country was peculiarly led by Donald Trump.
Against that, and that moderate was largely Republican conservative
and
agenda.
That was largely divorced from policy.
In Trump's government was the wife of Mitch McConnell, Elaine Chao. Was she more or less a spy for her husband?
Well, yeah. I mean, the interesting thing about Donald Trump's government, you didn't really have to spy on it. Donald Trump didn't do anything in secret. Donald Trump was possibly the most transparent president we've ever had. So I'm not sure what a spy would tell you. Possibly they would tell you he's crazier than even you think he is. I'm sure she told her husband that.
Yeah.
Yes. I'm sure she didn't have to tell her husband that. He knew it.
You bring in my historian brain an idea. Just think, Richard Nixon would have tweeted like Donald Trump.
No, I mean Richard Nixon was a very buttoned down politician. You know, he was not transparent.
No.
He was not. You know, there was his outer demeanor and his inner demeanor. You know, Trump is not, his inner demeanor is the same as his outer demeanor.
In our first conversation, you told us that Donald Trump is making phone calls many times a day, a little bit just like Richard Nixon. And Trump is more telling people what he is thinking rather than asking for their opinion. And in your new book, he again is on the phone most of the day. I wouldn't ask you to unveil your sources, but it seems you spoke many of those people whom he had on the phone immediately afterwards.
Some, yes.
And one of them told Trump you were going to write a new book.
Yes. I mean, one of the people around him, I mean, you know, I've spoken to the waves of people around Donald Trump, and certainly I have continued to speak to, I mean, many of the people I've continued to speak through the process of writing three books. But one of the people that I did had spoken to, and I said, I'm gonna write this book, and then he told Trump. I mean, it was kind of, I think, probably a warning. But Trump said at that point, he said, "That guy gets ratings. Let's see him."
He loves you as a TV producer would love you. You get ratings.
Yes, I deliver an audience, I suppose. And then so I was immediately invited down to Mar-a-Lago to interview the president and to actually to have dinner with the president and the first lady.
The lounges open up for morning cocktails, which I'm sure is going to be welcome news for many of you. And also red carpet poolside photos can be taking place right now as well. All right? Back to the fabulous sounds of DJ Yuki of Yuki Productions. Thank you, guys. You're now at the 7th annual Palm event for 2021. Welcome to everybody. The gates are open. We're going to have a great time in the guest list. As you already noticed, is
take a picture with you.
Right there. Oh my gosh.
Your biggest supporter right next to you there.
Oh, I don't know. I've got a lot of them here, sir.
You got him, my man. I love him.
Thank you.
Mr. Wolf, we want to know all the details. I'll tell you. Because as a European from a country like the Netherlands, with its, you know, centuries old politics of compromise, and with not that kind of, let's say, entertainment Hollywood-esque politics, you know, this is the continent of people like Angela Merkel, sober people. Can you tell us how do you go to Mar-a-Lago? First of all, you can't just take the train; you fly there. Is there somebody who picks you up? Is there security? Can you give us that kind of almost logistical details?
Yes, I can tell you everything.
We would love to.
Okay, I'll tell you. You fly to West Palm Beach. You know, Palm Beach is one of those, you know, sunny climes for shady people. Anyway, you fly there, and then you call an Uber, and it takes you to Mar-a-Lago, and there's Secret Service at Mar-a-Lago, but they have your name. It's very easy to And you pass through, and then you arrive at the Mar-a-Lago is a 1920s was built by an heiress with a huge fortune, and so it's a show-offy place, but 1920s style.
Country club.
And so it's more, is it more Art Deco, or is it more semi-Latin, or?
The main room there, which you walk in, is a kind of a violent clash of many styles. You sort of have Renaissance Palazzo, Hunting Lodge.
Scottish Baronial.
It's
neo-Gothic.
And
lots of gold.
It's also
lots of palms.
And then you have you have Florida thrown into this mix, but it is. It's a country club now. It was once a private. Actually, Trump bought it to be a private home in the 80s, but then he ran out of money and he had to. So he had to remake it as a country club where people paid a fee. So he now lives in the country club. He's the only resident of this country club, and it's an old-fashioned country club. So you have these big posters that say, prime ribs night Thursday, or, Italian night with accordion player, or Asian night. It's
very old-fashioned.
Yes, completely. And in fact, most of the people there, these are, very wealthy retirees. That's who the membership is.
Because the weather, of course, is wonderful there.
Well, except in the summer when it's terrible. Oh. So at any rate, in this big room, this baronial Hunting Lodge room, that's where Trump does all of his business. So he's not in an office somewhere. He sits right in the middle of the place.
So it's
the
first place you enter, there is Donald Trump.
Exactly. And, and it's a very large room, and there are many sections of, with couches and chairs, and he occupies...
It's like a foyer of a hotel.
Yes, lobby of a hotel, exactly. And he occupies the central seating area, and his day is mostly spent with Republicans coming to kiss his ring and playing golf. So when the kissing of the ring is all done in the lobby, and anyone can observe this, anyone can listen in, entirely transparent.
It's like the opening scene of The Godfather.
There's
a wedding with this great party, and everybody comes, and they kiss the ring.
But he's in a room.
That's true.
So Donald Trump is there, and Donald Trump is also acting like he's kind of acts like the host or the maitre d'. He stops people. Hope you enjoyed your meal. Hope you're having a good time.
A concierge.
He sees a mother and a daughter, and he says. He says, "So your sisters, he's
charming,
in the Catskill, it's what we call a tumbler in the Catskill resorts."
I've heard that. Heard that he interrupts weddings and receptions which are there. Is that true?
Oh yeah, yes. I'm sure.
And I just say, do you miss me yet? We're saying we did get 75 million votes. Nobody's ever gotten that. They said, get 66 million votes, sir, and the election's over. Well, I got 75 million, and they said, but you saw what happened. 10:30 in the evening, all of a sudden they said, that's a strange thing. Why are they closing up certain places? Right? A lot of things happening right now. I just wanted to say it's an honor to be here. It's an honor to have you at Mar-a-Lago. You are a great and beautiful couple.
And he has. There's a lot of people from the administration who continue to come there. They're kissing the ring, but also perpetual hangers on. At any rate, so I went there, and then I was the Republican kisser, ring kissers were let out, and then I was seated with
him. What time was that? In the afternoon?
Yeah. It was, you know, I interviewed him for quite a number of hours, so it was sometime in the afternoon. And then he said, you know, and he was, I mean, I remember actually the moment he saw me, and it was like seeing his you know, long-lost best friend. Now, you have to remember that when I wrote my first book, you know, he tried to sue me, he tried to stop the publication of the book.
You told us all these horrible stories.
Yes, you know, it was again and again and again that I was the worst person on earth. But anyway,
which is true, of course. Now.
Yes, definitely. Anyway, he sees me now, and a light comes into his face, and it's like we're best friends are being reunited. And then he says,
"Were you prepared for that? That he would do that?"
I honestly, under the circumstances, hardly knew what to expect here. But then he sat down, or I sat down, and he says, you know, those two books you wrote about me, he said, they were very mean and very, very wrong. But then he said, but I don't blame you. I blame my people.
That's fascinating. And because he picked those people. So he's the worst human resources manager in history.
Yeah, well, whatever. I mean, it was kind of like, you know, clearly I'm willing to start over. Let's start over. And then, you know, we had a long, long conversation, several hours, and then he invited me to dinner with he and the former first lady.
The president, the former president, sat there with what Sarah Huckabee Sanders once branded as the enemy number one.
Yes,
for many hours.
Yes, and then there was this moment when actually Sarah Huckabee Sanders was there, doing God knows what. But he calls her over, Sarah, and she comes over. He says to her, she led the when Fire and Fury came out. I mean, she was really the point person of saying how terrible I was.
Again, there are numerous mistakes, but I'm not going to waste my time or the country's time going page by page talking about a book that's complete fantasy and just full of tabloid gossip, because it's sad, pathetic, and our administration and our focus is going to be on moving the country forward.
So he calls her over, Sarah, and he says, you know Michael Wolff. And she does this double take. It's like a movie double take. I mean, she can't understand. This is like crazy, it's the crazy town to her. But then he goes on, oh, he's the best writer in America. You know him, he's so influential, blah, blah, blah.
The Saul Bellow of journalism.
Oh, God. And then...
But what is she doing there? Does she have a job?
She's running for the governor of Arkansas. So she's
Mar-a-Lago is not in Arkansas.
Yeah, but she's there coming to kiss the ring. And I think at that night or the next night, she was having a big fundraiser there. So this is really, you know, Mar-a-Lago is in so many ways now the Republican or the Trump White House in exile.
If you talk with Trump, it's impossible, I think, to go through all you wanted to write in your book, because that's a hell of a job. What do you concentrate on in such a conversation?
It doesn't make any difference. He doesn't have a conversation. It doesn't. It's not as if you can say something and then he will respond to it. What he's going to do is just talk. I mean, and it doesn't really matter. I mean, you sort of understand this that he's kind of interlocutor agnostic. He doesn't care who he's talking to, who's sitting in front of him.
It's sort of a roman fleuve, as the French say.
Yeah. It's just blah, 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 blah. I realized I would get nowhere if I said, you know, how can you say the election is stolen? So I kind of went the other way. Okay, the election was stolen. How was it stolen? Who stole it? And then, you know, it just goes on. And you know, he's on a loop. So a lot of this stuff you've just heard before, and a lot of this stuff continues to make no sense. It's just stream of consciousness, you know, baloney, especially with the election, which is so focused on numbers, and numbers for Trump change constantly. So you're unmoored from any kind of you know, traditional measures of having a conversation. I mean, the numbers, the way they float. There was when that's the speech about, you know, I'm going to walk to the Capitol. There were apparently, you know, probably somewhere between 30 and at most 60,000 people were there. And during the speech, Trump said there are 250,000 people here. And then when I saw him at Mar-a-Lago, it was, you know, there were a million people at the at the speech.
More so than that is inauguration.
Yes.
You had over a million people there, which the press doesn't like to report at all because it shows too much activity. Too much spirit and faith and love. There was such love at that rally. You had over a million people there.
But anyway, it was a perfectly, you know, pleasant conversation.
The point of Murdoch saying, for us it's clear, Arizona is lost for Trump. Maricopa, the district of the major million city of Phoenix. In Europe, not everybody knows that Phoenix is a big, big city.
Right.
Middle in the desert, and the rest of Arizona is right. Nothing. And he lost there. Was that something you raised in that conversation?
No. I just understood that there is no circumstance in which you can oppose Donald Trump in this. You just won't get anything, and so you have to sort of come around. You know, as an interviewer, you have to come in through the back door and basically say, okay, I'll accept all of your premises, and now and let the person hang themselves. Which is why in the end I produce, you know, almost verbatim his extended diatribe here.
And then you were invited to have dinner with him and Melania.
Yeah, and that's also extraordinary. So
had you met her before?
Yes, I had met her once before. So that room opens up onto this patio, and there are, you know, it's a rather large dining area, maybe 40 or 50 tables, and so the president and their former president and the former first lady wait until the dining area is filled with people, and then they go in, and then everybody stands up and applauds when they come in.
It's theater.
Yes, and then he sits in a he sits right in the middle of everyone, but with a sort of a red rope around his table.
Like in that foyer, this hotel lobby thing where you just said that when he meets people,
exactly,
it's in the middle so that everybody sees it.
Right, and so and dinner is not really dinner; it's more like the head table at a wedding. And. And Trump and Melania are the bride and groom, since they spend the whole time, you know, greeting people, you know, and he keeps talking. His conversation continues, and it's undifferentiated who he talks to. You know, he starts with one person, blah 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 blah, and he just shifts over here to another person, blah blah blah, and it continues.
So you had dinner with the whole hall, not just with the two of
them. Yes, exactly. And you're sort of a prop. Oh, you know Michael Wolff, the best writer in America. And then
can you remember what was on the menu?
Steak, of course. You could order. I think that there was there was a menu you can order, but it's mostly steak and steak and steak.
And was the former president drinking Coca-Cola?
Diet Coke. Yes, he was. I remember it was quite hard for me to get a glass of wine. You know, because he doesn't drink, so they don't. You know, the waiters are going by. I'm going kind of like this, and
Melania, of course, she's from Slovenia.
And she's very good.
And her country, her country is now the president of the European Union. Did you know that?
And so, I did not know
And they
that.
Have excellent wine there. So did she offer you wine?
No, the president finally said, "Hey, do you want something to drink?" And then I got a glass of wine, single glass of wine.
Was it any good?
Yeah, it was fine actually. And then the Melania is she's very gracious and she's greeting everyone. Hi, how are you? Oh, wonderful to see you. I mean, it's that. There's no differentiation in the pattern, and they must have greeted. Lots of people, 40, 50 people. It's, that's their whole evening.
There is no intimacy.
To say the very least.
Now, I've heard that Melania, in what you call in your book, the insiders and the outsiders of the Trump world. And the insiders is people like Kushner, his son-in-law, Ivanka, his daughter, his chief of staff, Mark Meadows. And the outsiders is Giuliani, lots of strange
right.
people, Donald
right.
Trump's new girlfriend. And now I've heard and also got the impression from your book that Melania is more on the outsiders than on the insiders' wing.
Well, I don't know. Nobody really understands that relationship. And I think people go out of the way, especially Trump insiders, not to understand it. You know, you don't want to inquire too close. I mean, this is not going to earn anybody anything to try to pin down what's really going on in that relationship.
Also politically, in the sense of this first lady has on these subjects or on these views on the world and sort of influence on the thinking of her husband.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I couldn't even imagine what her actual views are, even if she has any views. I can't imagine if they exchange views. I don't know. I mean, there was. I recount a story on the night of January 6th when one of Trump's aides calls him and says, he's advocating that we need to put out a statement. Joe Biden is going to be confirmed as the president. You have to say something, and you have to say it in a way that suggests that this is going to be an orderly transition. At any rate, he calls the president and then the president puts on calls the first lady the phone. He says, "Oh, I'm here with our great first lady."
So she's there.
Yes, and she was there at that point. And then she gets on the phone and says agrees that they should do this. And but at the same time, other aides will say, they have never been sure exactly where she lives. Whether she lived with her parents in Maryland, not far away, where she had bought them a house. And likewise in Florida, does she live at Mar-a-Lago or does she live with her parents? It's one of those things that nobody really wants the answer to.
Do her parents also have a house near Mar-a-Lago?
Yes, yes.
So it's a sort of dynastic thing. With those children of Trump from his former marriages and she and her parents. It sounds very European dynastic.
Yeah, possibly, yes. Nobody can figure. Literally, people say, "I don't want to," the people around him, "I don't know, I don't want to go there. I've heard, but I don't want to go there."
How did this dinner end? With vanilla ice cream or?
That's a funny thing. There was some kind of over-the-top dessert. And then it was, and then they got up at seemed to be an appointed hour. And again, it's just more saying good, it's another 15 minutes to get out of the room as they pass other tables. And, you know, then, and I was actually tired at this point.
I can imagine.
You were gobsmacked,
as the British say.
Yes. I got to get my Uber.
Yeah, you didn't sleep there that night.
No. Nor was I invited. And I don't know the, it's a curious thing about what that process is in terms of who stays at Mar-a-Lago. And I don't know it. I would like to know. I was sort of hoping for an invitation, but
I can't imagine.
Let's go back to January 6th and the last few weeks of his presidency. In your book, you write that Donald Trump only knows good lawyers and bad lawyers. He learned as a real estate man. But in the end of his presidency, he wasn't even able to hire a qualified team of lawyers. And the only one that didn't leave him was Rudy Giuliani, the former New York mayor.
Joe Biden is in the lead because of the fraudulent ballots, the illegal ballots that were produced and that were allowed to be used after the election was over. Give us an opportunity to prove it in court, and we will. You couldn't possibly believe that the company counting our vote with control over our vote is owned by two Venezuelans who were allies of Chavez, are present allies of Maduro, with a company whose chairman is a close associate and business partner of George Soros, the biggest donor to the Democrat Party, the biggest donor to Antifa, and the biggest donor to Black Lives Matter. I know crimes. I can smell them.
Why did Trump accept his help?
Because he said what Trump wanted to hear. I mean, that was very clear. I mean, Rudy Giuliani is probably the last lawyer maybe even Donald Trump would hire, but he was the last person, the only person saying what he wanted to hear. Therefore, he was hired.
Also on the impeachment.
They would not. Rudy wanted to be hired, but they drew a line there. They would not hire Rudy. I mean, Rudy was already in hot water with Trump for trying to get paid.
He was in hot water with Trump for trying to get paid.
Well, Trump and Rudy wanted, you know, I mean, Rudy had, you know, worked only for Donald Trump from November 3rd on till, essentially January 6th, or at least till the inauguration. And he wanted to be paid for this. And then Trump decided, no, he's a contingency lawyer. You only get paid if you win the case. And he hadn't won the case. Therefore, he got no money.
I don't know what to say, to be honest.
Yes. No.
What kind of relationship is that? It's a bit like with Netanyahu.
Yes. No. It's like all of Trump's relationships are like this. Certainly.
Jared Kushner said about Giuliani, "Do not hand over the keys to him."
Yes. I mean, everybody knows. I mean, Rudy is, you know, largely drunk all of the time. You know, well past his prime as a practicing lawyer. I mean, he hasn't really been a practicing lawyer in more than 30 years. He's incredibly disorganized, focus problems. He's not somebody who you would want to put your fate into his hands. No, I mean, all of them. I mean, the people around Trump are very particular in saying, you know, that many of the failures of this administration, many of the bad things are all, you know, that Rudy is responsible for.
And some people also believe that Giuliani in those days had the beginnings of senility.
Yes. Well, even the president has accused him of this. Yes. And the president. We're in a world in which it is really hard to appreciate how things could be as peculiar and nutty as this.
Now that we're talking about people who are, let's say, under the influence, we have the strong impression from, let's say, social media stuff, that Donald Trump Jr. also regularly is quite under the influence when he utters things. Is that true?
That I couldn't tell. I do not know.
Someone who isn't under influence at all, I think, is Mike Pence, then the vice president. He had to preside over the counting of the votes. Trump wanted him to come to his rescue, but Pence said it was impossible. In our first conversation, you told us that Karen Pence, the wife of Mike Pence, was one of the few that Trump was afraid of. Is she the winner of this all? Her husband emerged from January 6th as the moral winner.
Yes, no. I mean, I think that the team around Pence was very, very decisive in
in
understanding what they could do and could not do, and what they were willing to do and what they were willing not to do. And they didn't waver on this, much to the president's disgust.
The last sentence in your book about Trump is, he is home. Will we ever see him again running for president?
I think nobody knows the answer to that question yet. Least of all Donald Trump, probably.
As you said in your earlier books and now again in this conversation, he has no policies. He has no ideas to bring the nation forward. So why would he try another time?
You know, he doesn't like to lose. He likes the attention. I think it's pretty basic.
Very basic.
So you don't know what he will do? This might sound, we might expect a fourth book on Donald Trump.
We hope not. But I think I said that at the end of the second book. So who knows?
So... Thank you very much, Michael Wolff.
Thank you very much. This was the greatest, let's say, tour we had through Mar-a-Lago you could ever think of.
Thank you very
Excellent.
Much.
Excellent.
Thank you very much.
Bye. Thank you, Michael.
Bye.
Zo, dit was Betrouwbare Bronnen, aflevering 206. Deze aflevering is mede mogelijk gemaakt door de vrienden van de show. Mensen die net als Jasper, René, Jeroen, Tim, Thijs, Riks en Stefan met een donatie hun waardering hebben uitgesproken aan Betrouwbare Bronnen. Ben jij nog geen vriend van de show? Zorg nu dan dat daar verandering in komt. Ga naar vriendvandeshow.nl/bb en help Betrouwbare Bronnen mede mogelijk maken.
Heel erg bedankt. Wij gaan onvermoeibaar door.
vriendvandeshow.nl/bb. Ook wij gaan even met zomerreces, maar er komt nog één aflevering volgende week. Tot dan.
Betrouwbare Bronnen wordt gemaakt door Jaap Jansen in samenwerking met dag-en-nacht.nl.